Welcome and thanks for listening. This is your Nebraska Judicial Branch.
Greetings and welcome back. I am your host, Gene Cotter. The third-ish week of July is traditionally known or recognized as Probation, Parole, and Community Supervision Week. Recently, Chief Justice Hebekin declared July 18th through the 24th as Probation Week in Nebraska. Today, in recognition of that week, we are joined by Deputy Administrator Bob Denton. Bob, welcome.
Thanks, Gene. Thanks for having me.
There are 93 counties across the state of Nebraska in which approximately 14,000 adult probationers and 2,000 juvenile probationers receive services. Services that, because of the vast and varied geography, aren't exactly equally accessible across the state. Your division, Programs and Services, is primarily responsible for making sure that we identify and provide services to those under probation supervision, right?
That's correct, Gene.
So I can think of approximately three different major programs or efforts, services that are provided out of your division. Those are reporting centers, rehabilitative service vouchers, and transitional living. Let's start a little bit by talking about reporting centers. Can you just briefly describe to us what reporting centers are, what kind of services are provided through them, and like where across the state you can find a reporting center?
Sure. So, you know, you talked about the 93 counties and, you know, access to services. That is a major challenge in the rural areas of Nebraska. So when we started reporting centers in approximately 2006, the idea was to be able to develop these local centers in the communities. That was a collaborative effort with the counties. They would pay for the operations or the building, maintenance and space and things like that. And then probation would pay for the staff, for all the services, and to have a one-stop shop for the individuals that are under community supervision. So in 2006, when we first started reporting centers, again, a collaborative effort, also with local providers. So we contract with local mental health providers, service providers, so they bring their services into the reporting center. And again, it's that one-stop shop model for the individuals that are under community supervision. They come to the reporting center, they can report to their probation officer, they can drug test, and then they can receive a mental health evaluation, participate in an educational course, receive employment services, attend life skill programming, and also participate in cognitive behavioral programs. And the cognitive behavioral programs are really focused on helping individuals to think differently. In order to get them to act differently, they have to think differently. So probation officers actually facilitate these cognitive behavior programming groups with individuals that they supervise to help them to think differently and therefore behave differently.
Bob, when you say life skills, can you give an example of what a life skill is?
So the life skill programming that we typically offer focuses a lot around, you know, how to budget your money, how to manage your household, to make better health decisions, things like that. Really focused on life skills that a lot of people take for granted, you know, that individuals have. We have found through long trial and error that a lot of the individuals that we supervise lack some of these life skill. And so we provide that programming to assist them. We're really focused on the individual and their individual needs, but really the whole picture. So it's not just substance use. It's not just mental health. It's everything. Education, employment, cognitive behavioral programming, life skills, and so on.
Those are those things that are identified in research as really important to help somebody get a leg up and reduce their risk of returning to court, correct?
That's correct. If you only treat one problem that an individual has, but they have several problems, they're not likely to improve their behavior and less likely to be successful on probation and eventually end up back in the system. So you really have to look at the whole individual and all the issues that they need to work on.
Bob, are reporting center programs and services available to everyone? I know you talked a little bit about you do individualized assessments and determine who gets what and why they get those things. Is that evolutionary? In other words, maybe it looks like this in the beginning, but as I make my way through probation, do other things become available to me or maybe even taken away?
We really focus on high-risk individuals that are identified as high-risk through an assessment. And that's one of the first things that we do when an individual comes into our system is we assess what their risk and needs are, and then we develop that plan around that. So we're really looking at the individual, what their risks are, what are their needs, and then we're targeting those with specific interventions. So if somebody has mental health issues and employment issues, they're going to get those services if they're a high-risk individual. Someone that maybe is not identified as a high risk and maybe a medium risk, there are services available for them, maybe not through the reporting center. It just depends on what's available in that community.
And just to clarify, when you talk about risk, again, high risk is those facets of people's lives that maybe either prompt them to become involved in the legal system or prevent them from getting involved in the legal system, right? So when you say high risk, that means in certain areas of my life, I'm lacking protective factors that are out there. And that's the whole intent of the programming, right? Is to instill or institute these protective factors?
That's correct. We do assess for risk. So if they have maybe antisocial thinking or pro-criminal behavior, those are risks that would lead them to get in trouble again. We target those specifically. We want to build those protective factors. A really strong protective factor is someone that has good employment skills. If they have a trade or they have high-level education, those are very strong protective factors that research has proven that will keep them out of the justice system or keep them from getting into trouble again.
I'm going to move into treatment here in a minute, but the next thing I would like you to clarify is just talk for a minute about what is known as responsivity. In other words, you can't just plug square pegs into round holes. In other words, you need to address things in a certain order, chronological order, for example, or you need to account for things like this program is going to cost X amount of dollars, but you don't have employment, so how are you going to pay for that? That is known as responsivity. Could you talk a little bit more about what responsivity is and how it works when it comes to reporting centers and some of the other things that you do in your division?
So in addition to risk and need, we also assess responsivity. And like you said, these are very important factors of how an individual will be successful. For example, if they have a history of trauma, then we have to be able to look at those responsivity factors because we don't want to re-traumatize them. And for example, if we have a female individual that's under community supervision, a responsivity that we would look at is what type of probation officer or maybe a treatment provider would best work with this individual. So these are responsivity issues that we are always looking at. Mental health is another responsivity factor that we look at. If somebody has mental health issues, we certainly can't address other risks and needs without addressing that responsivity issue first. And so responsivity is a very, very important factor that we also look at.
What have you seen since 2006 in the utilization of programs like the reporting centers? I know that the state legislature has allocated funding to create, and part of justice reinvestment was basically the facilitation of additional reporting centers or service centers across the state. What have you seen from an uptick in the programming utilization during that same time frame?
When we first started in 2006 with the 7 reporting centers, we have since grown to 17. We have 6 service centers. So we've really expanded our reach with the reporting centers and made them more available to Nebraskans across the state. We've also increased our programming, and so we have really followed the research, what are effective programming. Our core programming is around substance use intervention, employment, and education, life skills programming, cognitive behavioral groups, and victim impact programming. So these are the core programs that we offer in every one of our reporting centers. Again, we contract with local providers, so it's really a community collaborative effort. And there could be something that's very specific to that region that reporting center would benefit with. And so we always look at what are the local needs, what are the local resources that would best benefit our individuals under community supervision.
Do you know approximately how many people access reporting centers on an annual basis?
we don't measure individuals, we measure visits. And in 2020, we had over 87,000 reporting center visits by individuals. So these are individuals that made multiple visits. That's why we don't count just individuals. But again, these are visits that include reporting to your probation officer, drug testing, attending a 12-step support group, and then mental health treatment, substance use treatment, life skills programming, and so on.
You mentioned treatment in at least two different aspects there. Historically, when people think about treatment, I think they think about substance abuse treatment, mental health treatment. But technically, a lot of things can be treatment, right? Much like you scratch your knee when you fall down or you get a cut, you treat those two things in different ways. And so these treatment applications are wide and varied, correct?
Yes, absolutely. There are numerous treatment approaches and different treatment programs available.
And just like when you go to a doctor's office and have to get different treatment for the different degree of injury you suffer, that's the same can be said for behavioral health interventions. You offer, through your division, financial assistance vouchers, which actually help people achieve and obtain the level of services they need to address their treatment needs, correct?
That's correct. So all the individuals that we work with during that assessment, you know, we're identifying if they have financial needs. And if they do, it's so important to address the mental health and substance use issues. Again, if we don't address these, all the other work that we do is probably not going to be successful for them. So one of our major priorities is their behavioral health needs. So everybody that comes into our system, in addition to that assessment, we also will do a mental health screen to determine if there's other needs that they have. And so if we do identify someone with potential mental health issues or they have a history of substance use issues, then we will send them to get evaluated. If they can't afford that evaluation, then we determine that through a screen, and then we provide financial assistance. We're always looking at individuals to be able to either pay for it or access Medicaid or their insurance. But again, if they don't have those resources, then we will provide those for them as long as they meet the criteria. Again, it's the high-risk individuals and all felony offenses, and then the higher-level misdemeanor offenses such as DUI third, domestic violence, or sex offenders.
When you talk about DUI thirds, domestic violence, and sex offenders, you also have financial assistance vouchers available for services in those areas as well, right?
We do. When we, in 2015, when we started working with individuals coming out of the correctional institutions, referred to as post-release supervision individuals, we identified that need for financial assistance, in particular for domestic violence interventions, such as batterers intervention. And so we developed a program that individuals that are on post-release supervision that need financial assistance do have that available for them. Sex offenders as well, if they need financial assistance, that's a very high-risk population historically, and we really want to ensure that they get the treatment that they need. So again, we provide financial assistance for them if they need it.
2020, if it did anything else during the course of the pandemic, it identified and heightened awareness around housing issues. That has always been a major responsivity issue when it comes to especially the criminal justice or the community corrections population. I know recently, over the last couple of years, your division has also identified help with housing vouchers. Talk a little bit about that program, if you would.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct, Gene. You know, housing has always been an issue for us with the high-risk individuals that we work with. A lot of times they burn bridges and don't have anywhere else to go. Most people have excluded them from allowing them to live with them, or they're couch surfing with friends, which is not a great situation for individuals that are on court supervision or community supervision. But particularly in 2015, again, when we started supervising post-release supervision individuals, we identified this as a very, very high need for these individuals. So we developed a transitional living program within our system. We were able to identify three levels of transitional living. The highest level is the halfway house, licensed therapeutic halfway house. So these are individuals that are transitioning typically out of a residential short-term treatment program, and then they'll go right into the halfway house, and they'll work with that continued treatment as they transition them back into the community. We also identified just safe and sober living for individuals that have 24-hour staffing, so we can ensure that they're always there, they're accounted for. And then our level one is the safe and sober living that has overnight staffing. We always want to make sure that these individuals that are high risk are where they're supposed to be. It's a community safety issue. And so it really assists the officer in knowing where they're at. If they're not there, then the facilities will let us know and they'll report to the probation officer and we'll go out and look for them. So the transitional living has been a important and needed service. And we've had a lot of support from the Supreme Court and the legislature and the funding. And we have built up a very strong network in Nebraska. We currently have 83 facilities. We have 1,245 beds that are available. In 2020, we had over 1,000 high-risk individuals that participated or provided that transitional living service.
Bob, you talked about people coming out of a residential treatment setting. Because probation deals with or works with people that are on post-release supervision, meaning they're coming out of either a prison, from a state prison, or a local county jail, if they receive their treatment there, that is also a possibility for them, right? They could transition from a correctional setting into a halfway house or a level one transitional living
situation. Yes, that's correct. Yeah, if they get the treatment within the facility, which unfortunately often they don't, but if they do, we would take advantage of that resource that they received, and then we would transition them into the appropriate setting. Now, we're always assessing people coming out of the facility. So even if they have participated, but they still have risk or they're displaying risk, then we would look at that and potentially provide further treatment for them.
Again, research actually demonstrates that providing supervision for somebody upon their release from a correctional facility gives them a much better chance of overall success and long-term lifestyle without recidivism, right?
That was one of the key findings that the Justice Reinvestment Effort identified, were individuals that were just being released from the correctional facilities without supervision had a high rate of recidivism. And so post-release supervision was really developed off of that research. So when someone comes out of a facility, we provide them very intensive supervision. We provide them the needed resources, treatment, all those reporting center services that I talked about, all of the programs that are really crucial for them to get better and not get into trouble again.
One of the mottos that has stood out, not necessarily in our conversation yet, and that's why I'm bringing it up, is in probation, you try to do, or we try to do, the right thing, not the easy thing. In other words, sometimes, much like when you're working with your own children, it may not be what they want to do, but it's probably the best thing for them. And that's kind of the path that you follow, right?
Absolutely. You know, we always want to give the individuals that we supervise a voice, but we really base our decision on that risk and need and responsivity. So a lot of times the individuals that we work with, they don't want to participate in all these. I understand that it's very challenging. It's a lot of work. A lot of these individuals that we work with, a lot of times will not acknowledge the issues that they're dealing with. So that's a real challenge for probation officers. We identify what the issues are based on an actuarial risk assessment that is proven to be able to measure whether that person, if they continue to have those risks, will continue to get in trouble. We target those interventions based on that assessment. The individual might not like it, but we've had so much feedback from the individuals that we work with that they didn't want to participate in these programs. They didn't feel a need, but afterwards, they're grateful that they went through it.
And sometimes that means they don't go back to the hometown that they came from for a while. They may have to go to one of these transitional living facilities, get the services that they need, reduce that risk before they're able to go home and rejoin their families.
That's correct. We want to keep people in their communities because, as you mentioned earlier, those protective factors, those community supports. But oftentimes, there's also a lot of risk factors in the communities that they came from. And sometimes it's better to move them to a different community, maybe temporarily, maybe permanent if they choose after they're off probation. But we definitely don't have the resources that we would like across the state. So we do at times have to move someone into a different community for that access to resources.
Bob, as we wrap up, I'm kind of reminded of the old children's song of "Who are the people in your neighborhood?" This is a situation whereby whether you've been in jail, whether you're in prison, whether you're on probation, you are coming back to a community. You're living in a community, and our goal is to make sure that you're a contributing member to your family, that you're a contributing member to society, that you are in a good place personally. The one thing that kept coming to my head listening to you talk was an investment. When you are supervising people and you're making reporting center services available to them, you're investing in them, you're paying for them if they are unable to, or at least in part through the financial assistance vouchers, you are investing in them to go get the treatment services they need to become the people that they want to be. And reporting centers, you're actually investing in services in communities where they weren't previously. So just wrap up, if you would, by talking about just the overall investment that you're making in the probationer themselves as well as the communities in which they are, because everybody is actually a citizen of the community in which they're being served or the county in which they're being served.
Yeah, that's a great point, Gene. You know, individuals that get involved in the court system, their mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, you know, they have family, they have community connection. And so just to put someone in jail, that's an investment in itself, and it's a very expensive investment. And research has proven just putting someone in jail or prison is not effective at getting them to walk the straight and narrow. That a lot of times when people go to prison, sometimes they come out worse. They make bad connections. They learn bad skills while they're incarcerated. And so community supervision really allows those individuals to address the issues that led them into the justice system, keeping them in their community, allowing for them to continue to work, support their families, support their children, support the community, contribute to the community, whether it's taxes or not having to pay child support and so on. So we really look at community supervision, like you said, it's an investment, not only in the individual, but in their family, in the community. And it's really a more effective way at getting people to change their behavior and not keep getting in trouble over and over and over again. I think a lot of research over the years has shown that putting people in jail and prison creates a revolving door. They go in, they come out, back to those communities, back to those families. They go in again, they come out, they go in. What we're really trying to accomplish is to prevent that revolving door. By helping one individual, I believe, has exponential benefits for the community. Again, helps that individual, it helps their family, they pay taxes, they contribute, and overall, that community becomes safer and stronger.
As we put the finishing touches on Probation Week 2021, Bob, thank you very much for highlighting the services and the investment we make, not only in the individuals served by probation, but the communities in which they live.
Thanks, Gene.
This has been another episode of Your Nebraska Judicial Branch. Please remember to subscribe, like, and review us on your favorite podcast platform.